The Jewish Hour can now be heard on jcastnetwork.org, your portal to Jewish broadcasting. It's also on iTunes and on your smartphone using the Stitcher app. Welcome to the Jewish Hour. I'm your host, Herschel Finn, and we've got a great show for you today. This half hour, we're going to talk about Yiddish music, per se, specifically, with world-renowned Yiddish musicologist Henry Sapozhnik, who is now with the Mehrent Institute of Yiddish Culture. We have lots of wonderful music for you today. The portion of the week is the portion of Re'eh. And, of course, a dynamite Hasidic story. You want to stick around for this story, folks. Before we do anything else, let's go right to the news. Two days after the last 72-hour ceasefire began, a team of Hamas bomb experts unsuccessfully disarmed an Israeli rocket that did not explode, killing five people, including an Italian journalist who was reporting on the dismantling. Israel is refusing to a peace agreement that does not include the return of the bodies of two IDF soldiers killed in Gaza. Hamas says it will return the bodies if every Hamas terrorist held in Israeli jails is released. Hamas also insists on an airport and seaport in Gaza as a beginning for peace negotiations, but is willing to stop building tunnels into Israel. Thank you very much. An IDF Special Forces unit arrested 12 terrorists that were planning attacks on a village south of Hebron. No one was hurt in this arrest. Hamas's information ministry confirmed that journalists who filmed missile launch sites were given a chance to change their stories or be deported from Gaza. Foreign journalists who filmed rocket launches were considered by Hamas to be collaborators with Israel. Israel's defense ministry requested an additional $5 billion to pay for Operation Protective Edge. The money would go for restoring arms. Israel's deficit is close to 3% of its gross national product. The war cost Israel more than $3 billion, which includes lost revenues. Someone told me they were at the Citadel Hotel last week, and they were virtually the only person there. Go to Israel, please. The Old City of Jerusalem, built by King Solomon more than 3,000 years ago, is undergoing improvements to aid the handicapped. Ramps are being installed over stairs near the Western Wall to aid wheelchairs. Signs are being made more accessible for low vision people, and other things are being installed to aid the handicapped. Israel's Davis Cup match against Argentina next month was moved from Israel to Sunrise, Florida, because of the conflict in Gaza. The neutral venue was proposed by the Israel Tennis Association. Israel signed an investor visa pact with the U.S. The agreement would make it easy for Israelis to invest in America and Americans to invest in Israel, making everybody that much more healthy. And normally I would save this for the PSAs, but this is important enough to close the news with. Nechama is a volunteer-based disaster relief organization. They help those affected by flood. If you are able to volunteer in the greater Detroit area, which is a lot of people got basements going on, we know that. No experience necessary. It's greatly appreciated. Go to their website, www.nechama.org. That's N-E-C-H-A-M-A.org, nechama.org. If you need help with your basement and throwing stuff out, you got to get that done really, really soon. Call 248-592-2313. That's 592-2313. If you forget the number, call the JFS, the Jewish Family Service, and they can put you through to the Nechama people, and that's the news.
Some of the best jobs in the world are in the radio and television industry, and you too can join the workforce in as little as 8 months when you complete your hands-on training at the Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts located in Southfield, Michigan. At Specs Howard School, students get to play and learn at the same time. Imagine spending your class time behind the microphone, spinning music and hosting your own radio show, or designing and lighting a set for your own TV program, running a camera, learning to edit, directing a program, When you go to Specs, your day will be anything but dull. And if school is this fun, imagine how exciting it is to work in the growing industry. In addition, the credits you earn while attending Specs Howard School are currently accepted at 14 area colleges and universities. If you've always wanted the best job in the world, call for a tour of Specs Howard School at 248-358-9000. That's 248-358-9000, or visit them on the web at specshoward.edu. Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts. This is where you start.
Hey, Shul Finman here. You're listening to the Jewish Hour. We are online with Henry Sapochnik, who is a world-famous Yiddish musicologist. How are you today, Henry?
I'm fine. Thank you so much for calling.
Thank you so much for taking some of your time to be with us. We talk about Yiddish music on time to time here on the Jewish Hour. We've been on air for 18 years now, and every once in a while the subject comes up.
Hi, very nice.
Yes. Can you give us a clear and like the definitive definition, there you go, of Jewish music?
Ooh, yeah, like this is like Rashi of Ain Feet.
Yeah.
This on one, standing on one foot.
No, we have about 20 minutes, so. Like, for example, I'll give you an example.
Jewish
I don't play.
A lot. There's a lot to take in there. I mean, you could. There's the famous quote that, you know, Jewish culture is anything that Jews respond to. But I think maybe in my case, to do it in a more concise way, my interest is in Yiddish music, which really talks about the Jews from Eastern and Central Europe, anyone who spoke the language and the music that was part of the soundscape and the cultural world that they came from. That religious music, chazonis, it's folk music, it's the music of the popular Yiddish stage, of radio, of film. So it's a very diverse, very rich culture, a musical culture, that, like the language, the music has been part of that extended community for over 1,000 years.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. Like I was going to say, we don't play Bob Dylan or Simon Garfunkel on our show, even though that's music that's done by Jews, per se, because I don't consider that Jewish music. It's something Jews did, but it's not. I wouldn't call it Jewish, per se. So
yeah.
What's klezmer music, and what are the roots of klezmer music?
The same as the roots of the culture. I mean, we're a people, and the tradition of having to celebrate the bride and groom at a chasana goes back. It's one of the earliest cultural dictates. Yiddish klezmer music goes back to the earliest foundings of the Yiddish world on the banks of the Rhine River, and you know, during the Middle Ages. We don't know what it sounded like back then. There weren't recordings for hundreds more years, but we have a very good idea from what was written about it and recollections that music sounded like traditional music of Eastern Europe, fiddles, drums. And because we're such a music rich civilization, the modes, the shtegel, as they call them in chazonis, the shtegel, the modes and the scales of the music are there. In it's part of everyone's birthright. Going to shul for Shabbos and Yontif, the internal structure of what the music sounds like, the very vocal human sound of the music, is part of the legacy.
Mm-hmm. Later on in the show, we're going to be playing a song that was done by Margot Leverett and the Klezmer Mountain Boys. It's called the Hanga Highway Blues. And what is it? It's a mash of a bluegrass song and a klezmer tune. And there seem to be lots and lots and lots of similarities with klezmer, bluegrass, Irish, gypsy music. How did the development of klezmer differ alike? Is this all, if I would be Irish, I'd be playing Irish klezmer music?
I think the issue of fusion, I mean, there is no such thing as a pure music. Bluegrass is a mixture of blues and Scots-Irish fiddle music. The issue of what people played, what Jews played in a particular place, more times than not, would reflect the shared culture. I mean, if Jews and Gentiles have had historically a very checkered relationship, the one place that Jews and Gentiles found the most point of commonality in Eastern Europe was in the playing of music. You may not like someone because they killed Christ, but you say, whoa, they're an awfully good fiddler. So the idea of music that sounds like the neighbors is not, in Eastern Europe, it's not uncommon. There was, sadly, for all of the Jews who lived down south, there is no, and you're talking to someone who expertise on Yiddish music is like my knowledge of country music, the mixture of bluegrass and klezmer is a very modern thing, and it's an artistic statement. It's not a historic statement. What Margo and other people do is to put together two music forms that they personally like, not ones that have an historic connection or similarity. They do the same thing. Well, bluegrass isn't the dance music. Old time is dance music. Irish music is dance music, for the most part. So I think it's just, this really talks about how we live in a much more dynamic soundscape today, that we hear more music in a year than our ancestors heard in a lifetime.
Oh, because of media.
And so these mixtures are interesting and colorful, personal, artistic statements. They don't really talk about, like when klezmer and jazz was mixed in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s, that was because American Jews were part of there was a lot of influence to become part of the dominant American society. So the sound of the music was organic because Jews identified both with the Jewish music and with American popular music.
Okay. If you're just joining us, our guest is Henry Sapoznik, and we're talking about Yiddish music, klezmer music, per se. Now, Yiddish has a progressive development. It's like a composite of a zillion languages. And my mother used to always complain. My mother spoke a very good Yiddish, as we would say. And she used to complain about the Yiddish word for sweater, which in... when she was growing up, her mother told her that the Yiddish word for sweater was sveder. And she said, no, that's just what people call a sweater, and you're just making it sweater instead of sveder. Because in England, and I know when I was in Australia, they used to call a sweater jumper, per se. And I don't know how you would spell jumper in Yiddish, because there's no J, like a Dalet Zion.
A Dalet and a Zion.
Yeah, indeed. So it's obvious that there is no pure Yiddish word for sweater, because there's such thing as pure Yiddish. Now, with the develop of Yiddish music over the ages...
It's an adaptation. I mean, that's how languages are, that they have to sometimes borrow terminologies. Why, in the computer world, they could come up with another word than glitch, but they had to borrow glitch from Yiddish in order to come up with a...
Right, which comes to the word glitchic, colorful, which means to slip or to fall. Yes, indeed. So then, can you tell a difference, you're a trained person, you know, this is your passion, between, say, klezmer music from Russia as opposed to klezmer music from the Ukraine as opposed to klezmer music from Poland or Romania? With the influences that were around them, what they may have picked up from their local contemporary music, Henry?
Do you mean I myself or can one do it?
Can one do it? Yeah, is it possible to be done?
Yeah, I think at one time, when regional styles today it's not, there really isn't such an ability, because we hear so much different stuff, and the influences that people bring to their music don't necessarily just reflect where they live. I mean, with the internet, with commercial recordings, with radio, people can hear and come up with sounds that are completely unique. If we're talking about, like, for example, the collection of Yiddish sound recordings that I curate as the director of the Mehrent Institute at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, we have 9,000 or more, getting more, Yiddish 78s from the late 1890s through the 1950s. And on the earliest ones, before sound recording was really a mature industry, Yiddish records starting being made at the beginning of the 20th century, if you hear recordings from Lembeck, or you hear a recording from Warsaw, or you hear a recording from St. Petersburg, they sound like where they come from, because people's influences were regional. Now, it's not really possible, because we hear so much, and it transcends where we live, and it's more bordered by what we like.
Mm-hmm, indeed. So, I have a quite little, so now a little back and forth the question I have. Yiddish is not my first language. Yiddish was spoken in my house between my mother and grandmother, so the kids shouldn't understand. But I managed to pick it up, and then it got to the point where my aunt would say something to like, Zug Gornish is Herschel versteht. Don't say anything. Herschel understands what you're talking about.
Yeah, a lot of families are like that.
Yes, indeed. So now, I was in yeshiva and with me. So now that I'm not a first language Yiddish person, so whenever I'm looking for a Yiddish word, I'm looking for a word which is not English to be a Yiddish word. So I was once sitting in yeshiva, and there were two students who were native Yiddish. And one of them said to the other one, "Kannst du gehen zu store and kaufen für mir a pack of cigarettes?" Okay, so I still looked at him and said, "That's not Yiddish. You just spoke English with a Yiddish word thrown in it." And he said, "No, I'm speaking Yiddish." So we have these different fusions going on. Like Frank London will throw some like really weird Frank Zappa type thing in it. Or you have like from the 40s when people were listening to swing music. So you had the WNEW Yiddish Swing Hour. What percent of the music has to be, or what's making it still Yiddish music as opposed to swing or avant-garde, or you have the hip-hop hoodios that are doing hip-hop Jewish music, and it's hip-hop, it's not Jewish, it's a Jewish, it's not hip-hop. So where do we say, no, that's no longer Jewish music, you've now gone into the other genre that you're trying to fuse it with?
I think it depends on the listener. Honestly, fusion is a personal artistic statement. For some people, any mixture of stuff other than what they grew up with makes it un-Jewish. I think it depends on the literacy and the finesse and the artistry of the performer to balance the two sounds. Sometimes it's more effective than other times. So I think it's just what identifies Jewish music to you. Does it have to be in a particular mode? Do you have to hear the stylistic techt, that moaning sound? Do you have to hear a particular melody? I think fusion and this kind of stuff, time will tell whether this is really representative of Jewish music or more representative of just the time and the artists who created it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, again, if you're just joining us, our guest today is Henry Sapochnik. He is the curator of the Mehrent Institute of Yiddish Culture at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And we're talking about Jewish music. I have a Facebook friend, goes all the way back to eighth grade. And his name is Michael Kaplan, and he's a jazz musician. He's got a non-tent and plays in New Jersey. And the one story I have about Michael Kaplan, he's a really cute kid. It was, we were sitting in gym class, And the gym teacher the first day of class was saying, you have to change your socks religiously. And Michael Kaplan looked at me and said, Baruch atah Hashem Elokeinu melech haolam, changing your socks. So, but anyway, so Michael Kaplan posted on Facebook that he wanted to know about Count Basie and the St. Louis Blues. So I posted him back, I don't know about Count Basie, but try this one on. I sent him the link to Mickey Katz singing the St. Louis Blues, which is the St. Louis mm-hmm. Blues, okay? Which that, it's he used the same tune and then parodied it and says sings it all in Yiddish. So the music is the St. Louis Blues. The words are Yiddish. Are we going to call that Jewish music?
Yeah, I mean, Katz is a parodist. I mean, that's what the band he came out of, where he got that idea, Spike Jones, that was their
genre.
That was their method. The musicians were good enough that they could play any genre. And Katz very successfully, brilliantly, did the same thing for Yiddish. So it was all takeoffs. Everything was based on pop music of the time. Borscht Riders in the Sky, Schleppin' My Baby Back Home. That was what made it so successful, is that for the assimilated Jews, it was just enough Yiddish to infuse it with that, because all the jokes were in Yiddish, or in his heavily dialect. But the idea is always buried in the center of all of Katz's arrangements. He had Manny Klein, and Ziggy Elman, who were the guys who, in pop music, Ziggy Elman's And the Angels Sing was a huge, huge hit. And he based it solely on this Bulgar that obviously he must have played when he was younger. And so Katz was a really, he understood how to balance both the popular stuff that he was parodying, and also when it came time to play the Bulgars, and when it came time to play the Jewish part of the program, it was always what we say, medaktik. It was always like really kosher. He didn't parody the klezmer stuff. He played it very straight.
Mm-hmm, indeed. Okay, you mentioned before that the klezmer music started as originally dance music, but there is a whole faction in klezmer Jewish music, ballads. And the ballads are all very mournful and life stinks and probably mirroring what European Jewry was going through. Could you talk about dance music versus ballads, Henry?
You mean instrumental music versus song?
Yes.
Two very important parallel repertoires. But yeah, the songs reflect a very broad diversity of experiences, as does the music too. It's not so, but again, Yiddish song, the folk song, the tradition is vast and is certainly as large as the Chazonis tradition. And that's been the idea of documenting this and making all of this accessible is it's a lot of the work that's been going on, certainly that I've been doing for decades, to try to create a platform where people can not only hear this stuff, but be part of the cultural continuity in terms of Yiddish music. And to that end, I run an event called Klez Camp.
Oh, let's hear about Klez Camp.
Klez Camp was started in 1985, and it was basically the idea was to create a continuity between the living masters, the national treasures of the Yiddish world, the great klezmer musicians like Dave Karras or Max Epstein or Sid Beckerman, and the great carriers of Yiddish music and Yiddish language, with a new generation of young people. And we have, since 1985, in 30 years, there's been over 20,000 people who have come And this year, our 30th anniversary, December 24th to the 30th, will in fact be the last CLES camp.
The last CLES camp?
And we're really looking to make it a very meaningful transition after having trained several generations of young people from around the world, Jews, non-Jews, musicians, everyday people. So it's very important to place the music and the language and the culture in a viable way that it becomes organic for people to continue with the culture in a contemporary Jewish world.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. That's fascinating. But you say it's the last one.
It is the last of the week-long. We hold it over Christmas week, because when we started, there was no one ever had Jewish programming over Christmas. I mean, Jewish programming for a lot of people over Christmas was Chinese food and a movie.
Mm-hmm.
But
even a parody song about that, yes.
Our job in inventing CLES Camp was to create a model of cultural continuity. And now, what we did 30 years ago that was unique and no one else is, now it's happening. As my mother, so the Latin Bezaind of Smotzik, as she says, Svezaina Minyanunins. There's enough people doing this now that we could do other stuff. So it's very exciting that what we created is now a standard in how Yiddish is continued throughout the world. So the good thing is that the work at the Mehrent Institute at the University of Wisconsin in Madison is going to allow even more of this kind of programming in a new 21st century way of getting the culture out to a whole new generation.
Okay, let's talk.
So
let's,
really
let's,
exciting.
Let's segue into that. When I'm thinking Jewish music, I'm not thinking Madison, Wisconsin. So tell me about the Mehrent Institute of Jewish Culture at the University of Wisconsin at Madison.
The Mehrent Institute was started in order to have a successful program at a major university with all of its great facilities, with library and archives and stuff, in order to perpetuate Yiddish popular and traditional culture. She said, wait, what's Yiddish have to do with Madison, Wisconsin, the Midwest? People don't realize that Yiddish, you have the usual suspects like New York and Los Angeles and Chicago. But mm-hmm. The great thing about Yiddish culture is that
Miami.
It existed wherever we emigrated. And having an enthusiastic university to help disseminate the programming. So we've been doing a program where we bring Yiddish music and teachers who have been honed over decades of teaching at CLES Camp. We do something called the CLES Camp Roadshow, where we bring teachers and performers and presenters into a community and infuse it with Yiddish cultural continuity. We have a program called a Bishul HaKles Camp held in Madison, succinct, modest-sized program that everyone can take part in. And a lot of important work, like the Mehrent collection of Yiddish 78s, is about to go live on the Internet. And it's not just 78s, but a lot of original research about these great artists who made these important records. I don't think people realize that of all of the other music scenes, if you're talking about bluegrass or Irish or Balkan, for any of those places, any of those musics, if you wanted to learn that music, you would get on an airplane and you would fly somewhere, and within an hour, you would find some old guy to learn from. The Yiddish world isn't like that. We had such massive destructive discontinuity between world wars and the Holocaust and assimilation. These old records were critical to the revival of interest of Yiddish music, because they were the voices of our masters. They were the leaders of crafting a Yiddish culture at the peak of its power. And it's a message that is still vital to us. You put on a recording of Gershon Sirota or Yoslo Rosenblatt or Dave Karras, and the years melt away. You hear the power in the immediacy of these things. So more people want to hear these. I have issued hundreds of these 78s over the years on anthologies, and they have been like the Johnny Appleseed of a new generation of players, that people hear the stuff, say, I want to play like this, and they make the culture come back alive. So there's a lot more work like that that needs to be done.
Ken, are all, you're hoping that all 9,000 songs plus will be accessible? I will be able to go to the Mehran archive.
Absolutely. That's the goal. And there's, we don't know how many more thousands of Yiddish records are out there, because they were made not only in the United States, but in South America and in Eastern Europe. So it's an amazing treasure hunt that will continue.
Mm-hmm. So you're for Yiddish records what the Yiddish Book Depository, I suppose, is for books.
Yeah, except records are a lot more accessible, because hearing music is a lot easier than you have to know how to read Yiddish. But we're doing the same place that you find old books are the same place you find old records.
Indeed. My board up wants to know, did you clean up the 78s when you digitalized them, got rid of all the pops and the hissing?
Oh, yeah. That's part of their appeal. They sound like they come from there.
Indeed. Okay, that's going to wrap us up. Thank you so much. Our guest has been Henry Sapochnik, who is probably one of the world's leading experts on Jewish music. He's the curator for the Mehrent Yiddish Institute of Yiddish Culture at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And I hope, Henry, that you keep us apprised of the developments of the Institute.
Thank you for taking the time to talk.
Take care. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and we'll be right back. You're listening to The Jewish Hour. Do you or someone you know have an addiction to opiates? Ready to take your life back but don't have the time for a long inpatient program? MDS Drug Detox is a team of physicians with extensive experience in the field of rapid drug detox under anesthesia. MDS is the nation's only rapid opiate detox under anesthesia facility, with the same doctors, RNs, and certified paramedics attending the entire drug detox process. MDS Drug Detox is safe and effective. Their goal is to provide the best, the safest, and the most economical way to free you from your addiction. MDS uses the highest standards of care and the best FDA-approved medications. MDS Drug Detox understands what your concerns are. Make the call today, 888-637-6968, or go online to www.mdsdrugdetox.com. That's 888-637-6968, MDS Drug Detox. Hey, Shul Finman here. You're listening to The Jewish Hour. And as I promised, we've got a mash for you. This is the Hanga Highway Blues, Margot Leverett, and the Klezmer Mountain Boys. assurance of quality and excellence in kosher? Look for the Michigan K on the label. What's it look like? The Lower Peninsula of Michigan with a K. It's the symbol of the Michigan Kosher Supervisors. Go to their website, mikosup.com. That's M-I for Michigan, K-O for kosher, and S-U-P for supervisors, mikosup.com, and find this month's featured products. You'll find Michigan K products wherever fine food is sold, especially at Natural Food Patch on West 9 Mile Road in Ferndale. Why go to a hospital to get healthy? At Encompass Healthcare, you get the state-of-the-art wound care like in a hospital. The same medicines, the same everything without being in a hospital. Why put yourself at risk of getting a hospital-borne infection? Did you know that last year, 1 in 6 people died in America because of infections they got in hospitals? Encompass Healthcare is an outpatient facility. That means you get your wound care treatment and then go home. There are no wait times at Encompass Healthcare like in ERs. Healthcare is personal and works better, faster, and easier. Encompass Healthcare provides a state-of-the-art outpatient facility close to where you live. Call 248-624-9800. That's 624-9800. Auto accident, workman's comp, and most insurances accepted. Encompass Healthcare's goal is to get you healthy with as little disturbance to your daily activities. Call 248-624-9800. Hey, Rachel Finman here. You're listening to The Jewish Hour. Now, for something completely different, this is Shlomo Carlebach, and he's doing something called Nigun. Nigun means it doesn't have words. It's just a tune of Ruzhin, of the Ruzhiner Hasidim. Ruzhin is a city in Western Russia, Eastern White Russia, depending on what day of the week it was and who was conquering whom. I think it was actually, at one point, it was actually part of the Ukraine, too. So, yeah, the border moved, but the city stayed the same. And the Nigun is very soulful. Let's listen to Shlomo Carlebach.
Is now accepting students. Whether you're a real beginner or have been at it for a lifetime, the Art Studio of Oak Park has something for you. All levels welcome, all ages welcome. Private tutoring or small friendly classes. Flexible hours available. The Art Studio of Oak Park is very affordable. Make your life better. Put art into your life. The Art Studio of Oak Park offers lessons in a strictly kosher environment. Call today, 248-542-5087. That's 248-542-5087. It's great having an art room right in the neighborhood.
Harris Schulfin, and here you are listening to the Jewish Hour. Today, this week, in the synagogue, we are reading the portion of Re'eh. The portion of Re'eh is usually read. The way the calendar works this year, it's kind of on the funny side. Usually, Re'eh would be read next week as an introduction to the month of Elul, which is next Hebrew month. But the way that the calendar worked out this week, and it would take me, a whole hour to explain the intricacies of the 19-year cycles that comprise the Hebrew calendar. And by that point, everybody would be listening to something else, so I'm not going to do that. But because of the intricacies, this year, the portion of Re'eh has, and all the portions until we get to Rosh Hashanah, are bumped up a week. The portion, though, now has the same meaning as it would were it the beginning in preparation directly of the month of Elul, which is the month prior to Rosh Hashanah, but we're doing it a week early. Okay. We know Elul, we've talked about before, has no holidays. It is a month which is totally and completely preparing for the high holidays, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Sukkot, Shemini Atzeres, Simchas Torah. All of those holidays are we're preparing, we're getting ready for them. This year, because of the way the calendar is set up, because as soon as I heard this, when preparing for the show and I saw the word Re'eh, immediately my brain, automatic, like in a Pavlovian response, said Elul. But then I went, wait, no, it's too early. We're a week early. So I'm reminded of another statement. The month that we are in now is called Av. Av consists of two letters, an Aleph and a Beit. An A and a V, of course. Aleph and Ves are an abbreviation for the words Elul Bo. Elul, the month coming up. Elul is coming. So here we have the month of Av is a preparation for the preparation month of Rosh Hashanah. So we're preparing to prepare, you might say. Why would I need to prepare to prepare? Well, an analogy is asked. It says there's a famous mimer, or discourse, from the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, which maintains that the month of Elul is as an auspicious time to approach the Almighty as the day of Yom Kippur itself. And we know the day of Yom Kippur is such a formidable month, a formidable day that everybody's sins are forgiven, and there's pomp and circumstance, and people fast, and they stay a whole day in the synagogue. Elul, it's a month. It doesn't have any holidays. But he gives an analogy of the king being in the field. That when the king is in his palace, you have to request an appointment, and you might not get an appointment. And even if you do get an appointment, you have to clear security, and there's all kinds of checks. And then when you do all that, and they finally let you in, they don't let you right in. You have to go first to this clearance, and then next one, and the third one, and the fifth one, and whatever it is, until finally you're let into the palace, and you're let into the room with the king, and you make your petition, and the king could say, no. Or he could say, yeah, put it on the pile, we'll get to it. But what happens if it so happens that the king is on vacation? There he is. He's not wearing his royal ermine robes. He's wearing what everybody else wears on vacation. He's got his khakis. He's got his Birkenstocks. He's sitting back and he's taking it easy. And you come and you say, yeah, he's got the big cigar, whatever, if he does or if he doesn't. I don't know. It depends on his health. And you approach him and you say, I'm sorry to bother your majesty on your vacation. And he's just really happy. He's all laid back and he smiles at you and he says, what can I do for you? And you tell him and he says, sure. That's what the Alter Rebbe says is that the month of Elul is all about. It's God's on vacation, you might say, so to speak, very approachable. And you can get things more accomplished in this month than you can even on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, as far as your personal relationship, what you need during the upcoming year. And the expression is, if you ask small, you get small. Think big, and then ask even bigger than that. And I'm not just talking in dollars. We have an extra week now to prepare for that, because Elul is also called the month of stock taking, when you have to look, how much do I have? How much have I accomplished? It's like accounts receivable, accounts payable. Have I given enough charity this year? Have I learned enough? How's my praying? How's my davening going? How's my learning? And all of these have qualitative and quantitative answers. I'm giving enough charity, but am I doing it grudgingly? Am I doing it with a smile? Am I doing it anonymously? I learn, okay, maybe not enough, but am I looking at it as a chore? I tell people with whom I learn, when people ask you, what do you do for your living? You say, I learn with Rabbi Finman. I says, that's how you pay your bills? No. Paying bills is one thing, but what you do for a living, you should look at the time when you're sitting and learning, as this is, but midem balepman would be the Yiddish expression. With this, you become alive. This is how you get your life. Are we doing that? So we have now a whole week to think, how am I going to begin my preparations? What do I need to do to start taking stock? That's what we have to do now this week. What do we have to do right now? We have to take a quick commercial break, and we'll be right back. Don't go away for the Hasidic story coming up next. You're listening to the Jewish Hour.
Hi, this is Specs Howard from the Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts. We're happy to sponsor the Jewish Hour and bring quality radio programming to the community. While much of the funding for the Jewish Hour comes from its sponsors, it's listeners like you that help keep the Jewish Hour on the air. Please send your tax-deductible donation to The Jewish Hour, 14,000 West 9 Mile Road, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237. That's 14,000 West 9 Mile Road, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237. Your help is greatly appreciated.
Herschel Finman here. You are listening to The Jewish Hour. Want to get in touch with me? The easiest way? RabbiFinman.com, RabbiFinman.com. Right there on the homepage, you have a way of contacting me. You contact me. I contact you. We become BFFs, which is best friends forever. And life is good. What else will you find on RabbiFinman.com? Well, you got archived editions of the show. Did you miss that awesome interview about candlelighting last week or about fill-in the week before? They're still up there. They'll be up there for a couple of weeks more. We keep them up for about 5 weeks up there. We have archived editions of the E-Parsha, U-Parsha, and Hasidic story, the U-Story, which are different media of yours truly conveying Judaism, and hopefully in entertaining and educational manner for you. There's classes there, and there's the very, very important donations page. We're still struggling to get July paid. It's already past the middle of August. They're very patient over here. Thank God. Salem Communications, wonderful organization. WLQV, great. It's one of the most powerful stations in the Detroit area. And if you're listening, you know how powerful it is, because wherever you are, you got it. You're listening. Go to the web. Go to RabbiFinman.com. Get prepared for Elul by donating now. Take care of all of your tithing requirements. The Jewish Hour fulfills those requirements. You'll be glad you did. The Almighty will be glad that you did. And all the people that are listening will also be glad that they did. And I hope they're listening and they give as well. Doesn't matter how much, just do it. Don't like internet donating? I understand. Send your contribution to The Jewish Hour, 14,000 West 9 Mile Road, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237. Back in 1985, there was a Rabbi Grossman from Migdal Emek in Israel who ran his institute back there. He runs it still. He's still around. Who had a daughter who was 16 and a half at the time, who one day woke up and had this like dye thing going on in her eye. And he says, what's going on with your eye? And she said, I don't know. My eye hurts. And he said, it'll go. Then he put some hot compresses on it, but it just got worse. And it started getting serious, and they took her to the local hospital, and they said, we don't know what's wrong. We can't determine it. You have to go to the big hospital in Haifa. And they looked at it, and they said, we don't know. You have to go to the bigger hospital in Tel Aviv. And they said, we don't know. You have to go to the bigger hospital in Jerusalem. And they said, we don't know. In the meantime, this poor girl, her eye is like, you know, it's all blown up and it's very uncomfortable and she's in pain, et cetera, et cetera. This rabbi had an opportunity to go to New York. And while, of course, he wrote into the Rebbe for blessings for his daughter, that she should get better. And he took her file, all the paperwork from all the different hospitals, to one of the leading ophthalmologists at the Ear, Eye, and Nose Hospital in New York. And the doctor said, I kind of sort of guess what's going on, but I have to see the patient. 6 o'clock in the morning the next day, she was in New York. The doctor took a look and said, this is very strange. I really don't know what's going on. They went to the Rebbe, and the Rebbe was just getting out of his car, and the rabbi jumped in front of the Rebbe and said, Rebbe, this is my daughter. Look at her eye and give her a bracha. The Rebbe stopped what he was doing. He stopped in his path. He looked at the girl, and he said, check your mezuzahs immediately. You may remember for the last couple of weeks, we kind of mentioned it. We had a whole show about mezuzah with Levi Kagan a couple of months ago. Mezuzah is a scroll which is put on the door, as it says in this week's portion, as a matter of fact. Actually, not last week's portion, the portion of Akev, that talks about Savtam al mezuzos beisecho visharach, and you should write these words on your doorpost. It's a scroll that's written on the doorpost. He called up immediately, and he told his wife, wake up a scribe and have all the mezuzahs in the house checked. When he got to the door, the mezuzah, the scroll was on her doorpost. It was missing the word einecha, your eyes. The mezuzah was replaced. An hour or so later, the girl said, I don't know, my eye doesn't seem to be hurting so much. I feel like I need to take a nap. When she woke up, the swelling was markedly decreased. They went to the doctor, and the doctor said, it seems like it's getting better by itself. The next week, there was a Hasidic gathering, and this rabbi went over and to the rabbi and said, the eye is getting better. And he said, getting better isn't good enough. It has to be perfect. And so it was. It got better, and they all lived happily ever after. That's going to do it. We want to thank you so much for tuning in. We hope we had a chance to educate you a bit. We hope we had a chance to entertain you a bit. We hope you have a great week, and we hope to see you again back again next week. Take care. Let me go. Let me go to that precious promised land.